The title is clunky, but the wine talk is smooth. You're listening to the Matt Talks Wine and Stuff with Interesting People podcast.
Hey, everyone, and welcome to the Matt Talks Wine and Stuff with Interesting People podcast. And we are doing plenty more interviews, South Island, New Zealand. So excited. Todd Stevens, the GM winemaker for Neudorf Vineyards, joins me now. Todd, I know we were chatting before. How bad did I screw up the name of the vineyard? I want to call it Neudorf. That's wildly wrong. For the listeners, how do you properly pronounce the vineyard?
Well, if you're being correct, it is German, so it is Neudorf. But as I sort of mentioned to you, us Kiwis are a pretty relaxed bunch, so we'll just take Neudorf as well. We don't discriminate.
I ran across you guys. I usually, if I see interesting wines at a wine auction, I always look at New Zealand. It's one of the first places I always look to buy. And I got a couple bottles of your 2014 Pinot. Opened one of them up this summer and was just amazed. 11-year-old, big and perfumed and full-bodied. And I just have to say, before I get into your journey, congratulations. You guys make some killer Pinot.
Oh, thank you. It's good to see some wine with age sort of out in the market there. I haven't seen that for a while, but I do remember that wine fondly, actually.
It's remarkable, actually. Let's go in a different direction just about how winemakers, your guys' memories about how you can, this was 11 years ago, and you probably remember so much about what the vintage was like and just what the harvest was like, even though that's over a decade ago.
Yeah, the finer details can sort of get blurred, but you'll always sort of remember the general sort of flow of the season and, you know, your thought processes at the time, particularly, you know, for little milestones along the way. And that was a wine which we, I suppose, in terms of my milestone, was something that we, that I recall quite easily, quite fondly.
And for people that haven't tried a lot of New Zealand, I would compare this was a really well-made, cool climate Sonoma. The one I picked was Costa Brown under their old ownership before they got a little bit bigger with their wines. But enough, I want to hear about you first. How did you went from a business degree? Ironically, I think you were working in IT, which is one of the reasons why we were late for this interview, because I was dealing with IT. How did you go from that world to making some pretty incredible Pinot?
Well, yeah, you're right. I was an Oracle database administrator, believe it or not. And I was in the UK. So that's it was good, but it was really ultimately is an office job. And I sort of remember sort of sitting in the office one day thinking, I'm not sure I want to be doing this for the rest of my life. That's quite often the easy thing you can work out. It was like, what am I going to do instead? And I just coincided with the fact that I was doing some wine appreciation courses in London. The New Zealand wine industry was starting to sort of get some traction. So I thought, well, why not give that a go? And I was fortunate. I didn't have a wife, didn't have a mortgage, and didn't have any children. So I could sort of make that transition quite quickly.
How did your friends and family, how did they react when you did such a 180?
Oh, there was a few raised eyebrows, that's for sure. Because obviously I was going from quite a secure, relatively well-paid job. But, you know, I sort of, initially they didn't quite grasp it. But over time, I think they've, I wouldn't say I've been envied, but I think there's been a few of my older mates that sort of said, well, you know, you made a good decision. I wish I had sort of thought about it a little bit.
Where did your passion for wine come from? If you are in this one part of your life, but you're taking these wine appreciation courses, obviously this is something that you had been passionate about for years.
Well, it's an interesting one. I think for me, it was the I was starting to get very interested in wine, but I came to wine quite late. It wasn't sort of I don't come from a wine family or a family of wine drinkers. So it was in my mid-20s that I started to sort of experience wine. And being in London, it's an absolute mecca for that sort of stuff. So you know, it got my sparked my interest. But I think the one thing that I was in IT, I struggled with, I didn't have a finished or tangible product at the end of the year or end of the day or end of the week to show my work. And I think that's what I liked about wine, that it's sort of at the end of the year or end of a season, you actually had something that sort of was packaged all up. You could actually physically see it and taste it. So I think that was a big role in pushing me down that track. Of course, also you get to live in some nice parts of the world. But most wine regions are nice.
I would say they all are. The worst wine region is still a place you could spend a beautiful weekend in. Actually, speaking of wine regions, what do people need to know about Nelson? Not only just what it looks like, but what it's like making and growing grapes in that part of the world.
Well, Nelson, just for everybody, is South Island, New Zealand, right at the top of the South Island. In the middle, and it's been a wine region that's been growing grapes, in context to New Zealand for some time. But it's a smaller region because right next door, less than probably 100 kilometres away, is Marlborough, and everybody would have heard of Marlborough. But we are quite a different region. So they're Goliath and we're David, if you want to put it in that context. And the one thing with Nelson, which is it makes a part of the greater regional sort of fabric, which is very fruit driven and agricultural driven and seafood. So we're not in monoculture. Viticulture only plays a small part of that. It's a double-edged sword, Nelson, in regards to wine, is it's not really probably known for one specific type of wine or one variety. If you're in Marlborough, it's Sauv Blanc. If you're in Central Otago, it's Pinot Noir. In Nelson, it's very much producer driven. So for example, we're known for Chardonnay and Pinot Noir, whereas if you go down the road to another small producer, they might be doing aromatics, they might be doing something a bit different. So it creates a great diverse region wine-wise, marketing-wise on the world stage, probably a bit hard to sort of get the message across initially. One of the reasons why we probably have gone down that track is our climate. Our climate's quite a friendly climate for growing grapes. We're one of the sunniest spots in New Zealand, so that means we can ripen, but we're not too hot, so it means we don't get overripe. So there's probably a nice sweet spot for a lot of varieties to do well.
So take us, Todd. I'm curious, what was life like for you those first couple of years when you've traveled now to South Island to explore this passion?
Oh, the early years, I came back and I made a commitment to giving it a go, and then we went and studied, and then ended up, actually, ironically, my first 8 years in the industry were down in Central Otago. That's where it was a young industry. It was really on the move, and I thought I wanted to be a part of it. And it is a bit of a baptism of fire coming from an office, all of a sudden to working outside, and sort of experiencing Mother Nature and being sort of at that razor's edge a lot more. You become a lot more in tune to what's going on versus what you used to be, because it's quite easy just to sort of get on the tube and sort of end up in an office and without really sort of a lot of thought as to what's going on outside.
What year was this? What were those early years?
You're stunning. I think my first vintage it was 2003, then I studied 2004, and then in Central Otago, 2005.
What led you to Nieuwedorf?
Well, so I was working for some very, I had the privilege of working for some very good producers down in Central Otago, so Rudy Bauer at Quartz Reef, and then Blair and Nigel at Felton Road, which probably some of your listeners have definitely heard of. It's one of, yep, if not New Zealand's premium Pinot producer. So they set, when you work for these sort of people, it's they set the bar very high. So you end up sort of thinking, well, I just don't want to go make wine for anybody. I want to sort of make wine for the right people who they sort of share the same ethos. And I was fortunate enough after 5 years at Felton Road that their position became available at Nieuwedorf as the winemaker, and I remember discussing it with Blair and Nigel at the time, and they said, yeah, that's definitely a place that sort of you should be considering, because they share very similar values, sort of at the finer end, I suppose, of New Zealand wine. So yeah, I was very fortunate to get the position.
What are some of those values?
Well, it's a smaller take. Without sort of getting, I don't want to sound too flippant here, but it's sort of you're focusing on at the quality end, attention to detail. You're certainly less commercial. That bigger volume winery, they serve a purpose, but I realised that wasn't for me. I wanted to be a bit more, I don't know, craftsman or artisanal.
And so you start there, actually flipping ahead a couple of years. You became the general manager a couple of weeks before the COVID lockdown. Is that true?
Yes. I don't think I remember that fondly. that was a crazy time. Our previous general manager had left. He was always planning on leaving, and I was always planning on, it was always sort of organized that I would take over. But obviously, we didn't know that was going to pop up. Very strange times, that one. That was a real baptism of fire, because you sort of all of a sudden had to sort of take the reins of a business where you didn't really know where the business was going to go. But thankfully, I've got very, very supportive owners in Tim and Judy Finn. So it never felt too stressful. We have a very open relationship with all of the staff here. Is sort of a lot of decision making, if I'm honest, is done around the coffee table at morning tea. We talk openly, and it's more of a family, type business. So we all got it through it together. Thankfully, that's at the back of us now.
Yeah, I was going to do some questions about COVID. I know winemakers here in Ontario, some of them felt guilty because at least they got to be outside and working and being close to other humans. But we don't need to relive that.
I'll tell you one story, Matthew. That's really interesting, yeah. Because you're in a different hemisphere. But that we were in the middle of harvest when COVID started. So we remember vividly that I was on the Monday. Our Prime Minister then sort of said, we're going to be going into lockdown, and we're going to be going into lockdown on Wednesday. And so we had just like, okay, well, we're still harvesting. The whole industry was in the middle of harvest, or just starting in some regions. And the precarious sort of situation was that they said only essential workers were able to go to work under certain conditions. And at that point in time, on the Monday, it was not made clear whether the wine industry actually fell into that camp. So there was about 24 to 48 hours of uncertainty of whether we were actually part of the gang or not of essential workers. So there was quite a bit of lobbying that took place. I think it was probably, we were never worried. Of course we were going to be, but there was a lot of uncertainty leading up to that that lockdown. And then we spent the rest of our harvest in bubbles and bubbles within bubbles. And it was a very weird time.
How is the vintage? Because I can tell you here in Niagara in Southern Ontario, 2020 was a landmark year, especially for the Reds and the Bordeaux varietals in Niagara. How was 2020 in Nelson?
2020 we're very fond of, outside of obviously the logistical issues, the actual season itself. We would say we probably use the word classic, if that makes sense. We're sort of using Burgundian terms, whatever that means. But yeah, a great harvest for Chardonnay and Pinot. All around the board, really. We had a nice ripening window, moderate crop, and a nice, I call it an autumnal finish to our season, where it just starts to cool off and you get to retain some acidity. So yeah, good wines.
And how would you, just for you as a winemaker, I'm always curious asking people in your profession this question, how different would you say you are as a winemaker today in 2025 versus when you got started?
Oh, it's certainly a lot wiser. That's what the gray hair sort of supposed to show. Yeah, it's interesting. When you come in as a newbie, you come in and you get your, I suppose, an apprenticeship when you work for the right people. You have that piece of paper that you've got from university, but really the real learning, particularly at the boutique sort of fine end of the market, you're really getting an apprenticeship, and it surrounds the areas of more philosophical ways of making wine and that. So you come in quite green with that, and you develop that over time. And then I suppose as you age, like a wine, you tend to refine it. So yeah, I think the transitions were steep, and then it sort of plateaued off, and now it's a little bit more sort of contemplative.
How many jobs do you have to do that you were shocked at when you were flying from London to New Zealand, and you and your image of your mind of what it means to be a winemaker? What are the jobs that you have to do that you're like, wait a minute, that's my job as well?
Yeah, that's the thing. We sort of all see the glossy photos in the magazines, don't we, of people sort of living a very glamorous life. I remember being told to me very early on that winemaking is 1% art, 2% science, and 97% cleaning. And I can attest to that. There's just it is the product itself, and the industry is amazing. Don't get me wrong, but yeah, there's a lot of hard, grubby, dirty work that takes place to sort of, you know, get that wine into bottle. You know, a lot of cleaning and vineyard work, a lot of walking up and down rows in the sun. We've all got to start somewhere, though. Thankfully, I don't have to do some of that anymore.
Yeah, but you still certainly get your steps in. We'll talk about the winery for a second. What do people need to know about your Pinot and your Chardonnay program?
Well, we're all estate growing fruit, and from 2014, the wine that you have in front of you there, that was the first year we fully committed to organic program. So from 2014 moving forward, it's all organically certified. And I suppose the philosophy in it's hand harvested, and we take an attitude towards wine that we really want to showcase the site and the season. So winemaking, of course, we may have to make some decisions, but we try to make decisions though that you don't see us. We don't really want to see my fingerprint. We want to see the vineyard and the site, ideally. So in regards to that would be things like we use native ferments, wild ferments, natural malolactic fermentations, our oak handling. We try to sort of have it lurking in the background and don't want to be too heavy with our new oak. And then sort of in regards to the Pinot is unfined and unfiltered. Chardonnay is just unfined and just coarse filtered. So we try to sort of like keep as much of it as possible.
I love this quote. You talk a lot about the winemaking community in Nelson, and I can sense just a very nice, healthy pride about not just what you got, not what you just do at your winery, but throughout the region. And this one line you say, "We may not have the loudest voice in the room, but we do have something to say." And I'm wondering if you could expand a little bit, just the pride you feel about Nelson and what Nelson means to the New Zealand wine world.
Well, yeah, Nelson, like I said, we're a small region, so we don't have the loudest voice, particularly when you realise the guy next door is a bit, you know, in context to, and I'm referring to Marlborough here, is, you know, obviously massive compared to us. So I think the, some of the great countries of the world that make wine, they have a diversity. It's just not one variety or just a couple of varieties. And I think that's where Nelson comes in. It can show the diversity of the varietal range that New Zealand can do well. I mean, a lot of, you know, and it is an industry where you rely on camaraderie and sort of flow of information to make sure that you get better. And that's one thing I say about New Zealand in general. We're a very young wine industry. You really think about it, sort of the commercial industry probably really only started back in the 70s to, you know, proper. There's examples of wine going further back, but commercially speaking. And New Zealand has managed to sort of pave away quite quickly and make a name for itself on the world stage. And the way we have done that is a lot of that's through flow of information and sort of realising that if we build the New Zealand brand and the strength of the New Zealand brand, then we've got a foundation to put your own brand on top of. So it's a great industry in that respect.
Does it amaze you, and I always find it such a cool success story about New Zealand, the winemaking nation that's in the furthest corner on planet Earth, and yet there is always a presence no matter where you go. I mean, I'm here in Toronto, Ontario, Canada, and there's the LCBOs, which are our giant, you know, liquor stores here in Ontario. There's always a massive selection of New Zealand wines, even though if I want to get to you, it's going to take me about 21 to 23 hours of flying to get to Nelson.
Yeah, I'll just sort of expand on what I just said, really. That's quite right. So we realized very early on that we're a small country positioned in the corner of the earth and that we were going to rely to be successful on, we'd have to export our wine. And in doing that, it's going to always be difficult when you come up against some of the heavy hitters in the world. But we were very fortunate that we had a wine which sort of took the interest of the world very early on when it came out, which was obviously Sauvignon Blanc. And that sort of gave us the ability to, so certainly in the early days, to explode onto the world stage as a sort of something to, you know, something else to consider. It was something new. And that in itself has provided a very strong foundation for additional New Zealand wines and brands to sort of build on. Now, we don't make a Sauvignon Blanc, but the presence of that has allowed us to sort of enter the world stage. And obviously, I suppose now that the narrative, you know, Sauv Blanc will always be there. It's well established, but the narrative of recent years is New Zealand can make some pretty good Chardonnay and Pinot Noir.
Agreed. My girlfriend hates Sauvignon Blanc. And when we visited North Island for 2 weeks, we didn't try one Sauvignon Blanc, didn't need to. Waiheke Island, Hawke's Bay, Gimlet Gravels. And again, this is a PSA to anyone thinking, if you don't like Sauvignon Blanc, you don't even need to drink it in New Zealand. Not that there's plenty of fantastic, you know, obviously incredible examples of it, but we didn't even try any Sauvignon Blanc. I also wonder, and yeah, but Sauvignon Blanc was great for you guys. It was sort of the tip of the spear. People try that wine, and then if they're curious, the next thing they know, they're trying single vineyard Pinot from the northern part of the South Island of New Zealand.
That's right. It's a gateway. We see it. It's definitely been a gateway. And yeah, look, Sauv Blanc is you know, it operates in a different sphere nowadays. Obviously, it's sort of at a more commercial level, but the diverse, and there's some very good examples of it. You're quite right. But the diversity of New Zealand is a varietal mix that can grow up and down the country, depending whether you are into Riesling, Chardonnay. Pinot obviously is well known, but then you've got your Syrahs and your Bordeaux blends, which New Zealand do quite well as well, and it's certainly coming from the North Island.
Oh yeah, Waiheke Island for your Bordeaux blends, Hawke's Bay for you, and Gimlet Gravels for your Syrah, and then the South Island for all things Pinot. And I recognize that it's a generalization by me. Obviously, yeah. There's plenty of good varietals all over the place. I also wonder if the rising price of Burgundy that's gone up so much, I wonder if that'll positively impact New Zealand, where it's not going to taste the same. It's not supposed to taste the same, but where you can get really high-end, really well-made Pinot Noir made in the exact same exacting standards, but is still going to come as a fraction of a cost of, say, Premier Cru Burgundy. I wonder if that'll impact the New Zealand wine industry.
Yeah, I think it will. It'll take a bit of time. I've just come back from speaking before you started recording it in Asia, and there's a strong preference sort of or gravitas towards Burgundy, for example, if you're talking about Pinot Noir and Chardonnay. But that's slowly being questioned from time to time because prices are always going up. And if you can sort of put this out, you know, in our example, our wines or any cool climate well-made Chardonnay or Pinot Noir, it could be from Australia as well, for that matter, or from the States, next to Burgundy, and that, you know, sort of go, well, hang on a minute, that's, you know, half the price or even sometimes quarter of the price. And it can only be a positive thing, I think, as soon as people, you know, sort of start to sort of do the math, really.
Yeah, you've traveled a ton. Is there a country, is there a city that you were amazed at that just loved either your wines or the wines of South Island, New Zealand? Is there another corner of the world where you may have been surprised about the high level popularity?
Yeah, I mean, we have to travel a lot, being this given our geographical position. Of recent times, I think, you know, Europe, we've been going from since 1978. Tim and Judy established in 1978, so we've been, I suppose, pounding the pavement for quite some time. And it's always been generally, I suppose, obviously Australia because it's very close, and then more, the more sort of traditional markets, which would be Europe and, you know, the UK. But of recent times, I've been very intrigued with the sort of growth or the interest in the Asian markets, and sort of in particular China. Just having come back from there, I think, when you get the wines in front of them and you explain a story, and they sort of you can sort of see them, there's a real interest, particularly with the younger generation. You know, they're probably less, I suppose, driven to, you know, towards Burgundy. They're a little bit more, you know, they're on their wine journey, so they're a little bit more accepting. So yeah, I'd say I was quite happy to come back from China of just recent times. It was very interesting.
Yeah, it's so much with your industry, with ours, so much of it is about storytelling. It's about getting the right psalms to get these bottles in front of wine enthusiasts so that they can at least understand, oh, okay, I might not have tried much wine from New Zealand, but the quality is there. You describe Pinot As I was reading one article where you're making comparisons to your Pinot Noir to David Bowie. I'm wondering, is it Starman? Is it changes because of vintage variation? Is it Heroes? Is there a specific song that you would go with to describe the Pinot program at your winery with David Bowie?
I forgot about that, and that's going a long way back now, so I'm just trying to sort of drag what our thought process was at the time when we said that. I'm going to go with changes because, particularly with climate change nowadays, you know, there's always a change. There's always a thought process that sort of you're always challenging yourself. Not necessarily to sort of change the wine drastically, but there's always something that's nothing's the same. Mm-hmm. And particularly with Pinot Noir. And Pinot Noir is one of those varieties. There is no hiding, you know, so you can see the change. So let's go with Changes by David Bowie.
All right. That's a good, yeah. Well, the funny thing about Google goes a long way back.
I know. I'm just starting to realize that now.
I had time on my hands, so I wanted to dig in as much as I could. What for you, Todd, and again, I'm always nervous with the generalizations of this, but for you, a good glass of your Pinot should taste and smell like what?
Yeah, okay. Well, that's a toughie. All right. So, the best thing I could, the best broad stroke I could give you is that I believe, and we believe, that Pinot Noir is a red variety which does, and I'm going to be very broad with the flavors, aroma spectrum here, does green, red, and blue flavors very well. And you shouldn't really be seeing black too much, you know, black being overripe. It's, you know, because at the red, at the green, red, and blue profile, you get a lot of nuance. And that's what Pinot Noir for me is all about, is nuance. So with our climate, I think you should find that Nudorf Pinot will generally have that flavor profile. Now, when I say green, I just need to sort of, because that can sometimes make people a little bit worried. I talk about that in a positive green. So it's herbal, not herbaceous, just to clarify that. So we'll always, I suppose, display a flavor profile like that. And then given our organic regime and our clay soils, we should still have a good fruit density and a structural element to the wine. And the key is just not to make it, you know, we don't want it to be a blockbuster. It needs to sort of sit together. So you should get a textural element too.
This next question, you can tell me, it's a dumb question. It can't be answered. Is there a general difference between if someone's buying a Pinot from Nelson versus, say, Central Otago, or is there too many other factors involved that you can't really answer it?
Yeah, that is a tough one. We do get asked that a lot to try and position it. And I understand. So I'll have a go at answering it. But you just have to take the disclaimer, the fact is that we're talking very high level here, because you're right, there's seasonal variations, there's winemaker decisions, there's all sorts of stuff which can really push this around a little bit. But most of your listeners, probably from a New Zealand point of view, will understand the two regions of Pinot Noir in New Zealand, which will be Central Otago, because that's obviously, you know, got an international profile. And the other region that they probably have experienced or heard of is Martinborough. So I use this very, and again, here's my disclaimer before I get told off by New Zealand wine growers, but yeah, here's my very broad scale just to try and put it into some form of context. So Central Otago at one end, you can appreciate, as you know, a nice volume of fruit, good display and attractive wines. And then, you know, at the other end, Martinborough, good depth of fruit, probably a little bit more savoury, a little bit more, you know, denser profile. And then if you're going to put Nudorf Pinot Noir, it's probably not in the middle, but it's probably heading towards more the Martinborough end of the camp than the Central Otago. That's the best I use that analogy a lot. It's the best I can do. I've never come up with anything better.
No, that's fantastic. Because, again, it depends on the weather. It depends on the decisions. Yeah. Depends on yield. You know, there's the clones, wood. There's so much stuff. All right. Yeah. We'll end with this. Early in this interview, you talked about how the one thing you love about your job now is you have something tangible. You made something. And I'm wondering for you, how much pride do you take? If you're at a restaurant and you see at a nice restaurant, they don't know you're coming and you see your wines there, or you're talking to a Canadian who tried a 2014 up at his cottage this last summer. Like, I mean, how gratifying is that for you?
Oh, very. You forget about it because you just sort of, you know, you come to work and you've got family life, and you know, after 20 years, it's become, it's just become the norm. But you're right, you do get little pinpricks, you know, every now and again, where you sort of, your bubble gets burst at a restaurant where you're sort of looking around and you see somebody has sort of ordered a wine, or you see your wine on a wine list, or someone from the other end of the world pulls out an aged 2014 and it's a wine you haven't seen yourself for, you know, 8 or so years. So, yeah, very gratifying. And it's quite humbling, to be honest.
And it must be so cool. Just completely justifies that decision you made many decades ago to leave one world for a completely different one. Well, actually, I'll end with this. What advice would you give? People are, because I'm going to be in your neck of the woods in late February, early March. But for people that are traveling around, what advice would you give them if they're coming close to your neck of the woods?
Oh, we've got a beautiful estate. Tim and Judy set this up in 1978, built it from the ground up. It's a stunning place to come and visit. We have a little cellar door with a lovely wine garden. If you're feeling a little thirsty after your drive from Marlborough or from Christchurch, please come and see us. One of us will be here, that's for sure.
Todd, really appreciate it. Again, congratulations on the success. Congratulations on your wine journey, and appreciate you taking the time to be part of the podcast today.
Thanks very much for having me, Matthew. Nice to meet you.
Thanks, everyone, for listening to the Matt Talks Wine and Stuff with Interesting People podcast. Remember, you can find me on Apple, iTunes, and wherever quality podcasts are sold.
Thanks for listening to the Matt Talks Wine and Stuff with Interesting People podcast. Happy hunting.